While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask what's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis right to you on Eagle FM. So thank you for tuning in into the number one talk radio station that is the home of informed conversation and credible national dialogue. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are listening to On the Reading News Analysis, the program where the day's headlines are examined in their full national and social context. Now, it is Monday, and this is the 9th of February 2025, and as the country continues to navigate the early weeks of the new year, public attention remains firmly focused on governance, on accountability, on economic resilience, and community well-being. Now, decisions being taken at this moment are not only shaping immediate realities, but also laying the foundation for Namibia's long-term development trajectory. Now, right here on the radar, we go beyond surface level reporting. We unpack policy decisions, interrogate their implications, and examine how national developments translate into the everyday lived experiences of Namibians, from urban centers to the most remote rural communities. Now, in a media environment increasingly defined by speed, competing narratives, and information overload, On the Reader remains committed to depth, balance, and clarity. Our focus is on context-driven analysis that connects policy, power, and the people. From 1300 hours to 1430 every weekday, we bring you expert insight, informed perspectives, and community voices. Journalism that seeks not only to inform, but to empower meaningful public dialogue. You can listen live on all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM app, and stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates and audience engagement. So wherever you're listening from, at work or on the road, or at home, stay with us as we examine the issues shaping Namibia's present and influencing its future. This right here is On the Reading News Analysis, only on Eagle FM. Let's get right into today's top stories. The Minister of Health and Social Services, Dr. Esperanza Lewin-Dower, has officially launched Namibia's National Digital Health Policy for 2026 to 2036, describing it as a defining milestone in the country's efforts to modernize healthcare delivery and strengthen health systems through technology. Now, speaking at the official launch, the minister said the policy provides a 10-year blueprint for the systemic integration of digital technologies into the health sector, aimed at improving efficiency, equality, and, equity and quality of care for all Namibians. Now, the minister explained that digital health refers to the application of information and communication technologies, data and computer science to support informed decision making and improve health service delivery. This includes electronic medical records, telemedicine, mobile health applicants, health data systems, and emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence. She noted that Namibia's policy is aligned with global and regional frameworks, including the World Health Organization's Global Strategy on Digital Health, the UN Global Digital Compact, and the African Union Digital Transformation Strategy, as well as the Africa CDC Digital Transformation Strategy. CDC, that is Center for Disease Control, positioning the country within a broader continental and global digital health agenda. Now, reflecting on Namibia's public health journey, the minister acknowledged the country's resilience in responding to HIV and AIDS and tuberculosis, as well as early digital inventions such as the introduction of the district health information software 2 in 2014. However, she cautioned that persistent challenges do remain, including a double burden of communicable and non-communicable diseases, inequities in access to health care, particularly in rural areas, and an unevenly distributed health workforce. Now, Dr. Luvinda highlighted fragmentation within existing digital systems as a major obstacle, noting that many platforms operate in isolation, limiting interoperability between patient records, supply chain management, and disease-specific programs. She noted that this fragmentation has real human and financial costs, often leading to delayed treatment, repeated medical tests, and insufficient use of resources. And but before I continue with this, let's pause right here and get hold of the PRO of the Ministry of Health and Social Services to feed us more on information on this digital health launch. Let's stay tuned. I'll be back shortly.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk. That's why I'm always...
Okay, welcome back. Now joining us telephonically now in studio. Wow, that's interesting. Joining us telephonically now is Mr. Walter Kamaya, who's the PRO for the Ministry of Health and Social Services. A very good afternoon to you, Mr. Kamaya, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon to you too. Good afternoon to listeners. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kamaya, talk to us about the launch of the National Digital Health Policy for 2026 to 2036. What is it? Let's hear from the horse's mouth itself. And how is it, why is it necessary for Namibia?
Yes, it is necessary for Namibia. It is necessary for the Namibians as well,
mm-hmm.
because we are talking about innovative now. We are saying the Minister of Health and Social Services launched the National Digital Health Policy 2026-2036. This is a blueprint that will provide for the next decades of digital innovation as far as service delivery in the healthcare service is concerned. This is a platform whereby the Minister of Health and Social Services intends to do away with paperwork, as we may have seen that paperwork causes a lot of headache, a lot of havoc. When a patient comes to the hospital, sometimes they misplace their health passport book. Some of them are green, some of them are yellow. And then we usually receive reports like, my health passport was stolen, it got lost, it got burned in my house when I was relocating, I lost it. All those long stories. But when we come to digital health, we'll find that all information or the health records are digitalized. So it's able to get them online.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, does it mean that I'm trying to understand. Does it mean that probably I'll have to carry this information myself, and when I go to the hospital, present it, or to be on the system of the hospital, or will I need to carry some sort of maybe like a USB, a memory card, and when I do go, they load it up on that, or how exactly?
Usually when we cannot say we carry USBs because those things do have viruses.
Yeah.
What happens is that this is a digital data whereby when we put or when we compute your data, we should be able to trace your records. The reason why we request our patients to carry those health passport books is for us to be able to track back their records. If it's a follow-up, it should be indicated in your health passport book to say that you were put on a follow-up. And then that follow-up, what is it all about? Basically, it's just to get the records that can help us to make a sound decision. But when it comes to digital, These things will be digitalized. These things will be computerized. These things will be able to be traced online, such that immediately when you identify yourself or when you prove that this is you, when they should be able to get your information at each and every facility where you have gone.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, when do we expect the rollout? We know that it was launched on Friday. When do we expect a rollout? And is it going to be sort of like a test and trial, or are we just getting fully into rolling out the digital health in practical?
The first stage, which is the policy launch out, is the one that we witnessed on Friday, which was done by our Honorable Minister, Dr. Esperanza Rubindao. The next phase also, we anticipate the rollout as soon as possible. It's only that it's difficult for me to give the exact date, but since the policy has been launched, we want to operationalize it. So we hope to roll out the system itself as soon as possible. We have engaged into other logistics that are aimed at finalizing the rollout phase as well, so that we have it operationalized, we have it working. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Haltis Kamaya.
Yes.
Now, reflecting on Namibia's public health journey, the minister did acknowledge the country's resilience in responding to HIV and AIDS and tuberculosis. And I know we are, I think we are almost there with a 95 target. What would you say perhaps has been contributing factors to that, to the Ministry of Health being able to combat well and respond very well to those? And would you say the same energy or the same strategy is able to be used on other communicable diseases, perhaps other diseases and non-communicable diseases in terms of combating them?
Yes, combating those diseases 100% without the participation of the community themselves, it's totally impossible. What we are saying is that the Minister of Health and Social Services or the government of the Republic of Namibia is trying to do its level best to be able to see to it. But we are one of the countries that have reached a milestone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that you have spoken about 95 targets.
Yeah.
So these are targets that Namibia finds itself in among few countries that have achieved that.
Yeah.
This means that 95% of people that have HIV AIDS, they have been initiated on treatment. 95% of them also, they are taking their treatment as they know their status, as well as the other 95%, their viruses in their body have been suppressed. So this is a milestone. So it's something that we can say the ministry have achieved.
Interesting. Tell us also about the ministry drafting the digital health bill. What are some of those things that we can expect to be maybe inaugurated or to be placed within that digital health bill? I do know that the minister spoke about a clear legal and regulatory framework in order to protect patient privacy and ensure data security, as well as regulate now the digital health providers. Give us more also on this.
Yes, usually what he spoke about, not a bill per se, but this is a policy which was launched. And from a policy, the system has to be developed that should be able to serve the health sector. Where there is a bill that is being discussed, it's on universal health coverage, whereby we have a team of experts that are conducting meetings in different regions across all our 14 regions, just to solicit ideas to give or to accord the public a change, to debate or to be able to share the ideas or to be able to connect and network with them, so that at the end of the day, when this bill is being passed into a law, people should be able to own it. People should be able to look back and say, we participated. People should be able to be grateful and say that
we had access. We were part and parcel of the process. So that's the idea behind.
That's quite interesting. Mr. Kamaya, I think you would be obviously the right person to discuss this. I have seen a lot of critics criticizing very long time ago when last year when the minister came into being a minister and she spoke about digital health. Some people made fun of it, thinking it's actually funny, not knowing that this is where the world is heading into and digital health is the thing now. It can actually help propel the health sector faster and forward. It just... Also speak on perhaps the importance of people educating themselves on the next best thing, because I'm sure when cell phones came into play and somebody was talking about cell phone back then, for those who couldn't believe that you can actually have it be in a conversation with somebody who's in America, they're probably criticizing. So maybe just an education on those who think this is fables, maybe.
Yes, I would say that usually when new things are rolled out, when new things are implemented, when new things take place, most of people tend to welcome such initiatives with a mixed feeling, of which as a ministry, we cannot be deterred from that because we know our mandate. We know our responsibility. But what we can assure the public is that at the end of the day, they should be able to look back and thank the ministry in terms of when this digital health policy is operational. And it is our responsibility also to educate the people to be able to understand, to be able to see the vision as well as the direction where the ministry wants to be steered. Yes, criticism will always be there as long as we do exist. But for us, we don't take them with mixed feelings. We take them as lessons that can help us to improve our future, such that our tomorrow should be different from our yesterday. But yes, we are aware of that. But this is where the world is heading to, unfortunately. The issue of carrying papers also, it is a burden on the ministry. Many a times we have received reports that we have run out of health passport books, whereas if we try to embrace this new technology, that will be something of the past. And that's what we want as a ministry. The issue of health passports, it has been there for quite some time, and then we have seen its ups and downs. We can attest to that. Mm-hmm. So with a new way of doing things also, we should be able to experience it, that wherever you go, your information can be accessed, your information can be easily available, and do away with things like, I forgot this and that, I don't have this and that, I traveled, my file is at this facility. But we should be able, so if a doctor, if a medical doctor wants to see your medical record, it will be easier just to log on the system and see those records instead of rerunning the tests, which were rerun last year due to other reasons that my passport fell in the water, it got weight, this page is not there. Other people take out pages, and then when they want to do their smoking, so a lot of things around that. So these are the things that the ministry is looking at. So that at the end of the day, it's also costly on the ministry to rerun things. Let me say, if somebody has taken an X-ray, wherever you go, you need to take those results with you. But when it comes to digital health, these things should be able to be found on the system.
Yeah. Interesting. Dr. Kamaya, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Analysis.
It was a pleasure having me. We'll talk again.
Thanks, okay, bye-bye. Definitely. Thank you, sir. In order to address those challenges, the Minister of Health and Social Services spoke that they've outlined 6 strategic objectives underpinning the policy. That is, 1, strengthening digital health governance. 2, developing an integrated and intra-probable infrastructure. 3, building a digital empowered health workforce. That will mean really getting their healthcare workers understanding how to operate it. And thanks be to almost, if not every course at the university now incorporates computer science, ICT, information communication technology. So it shouldn't be difficult getting that rolling, unless maybe for the much older healthcare workers, whom also I believe they can be equipped and trained on how to work with digital health. You know, fostering local innovation, that is the fourth one, and expanding equitable access through telehealth and community-based solution. And the sixth one is ensuring sustainable financing through domestic resource mobilization and public-private partnership. Now, she emphasized that the policy is a starting point rather than an end point, and will serve as the foundation for the drafting of a digital health bill, which is expected to establish a clear legal and regulatory framework to protect the patient privacy and ensure data security, as well as regulate digital health providers. That word they, or that phrase they, ensure data security. My goodness. Now we're talking about cybersecurity. We're talking about breaching of data. There would need to be a system, or be need to be a very secure system that locks away personal data, personal information. Imagine having seen a doctor, and perhaps you're a public figure yourself, and all of a sudden there's a data breach and your information is right out there in the public. That which was known as privacy becomes no longer privacy, you know. So there would really need to be a proper cybersecurity enforcement in place, cybersecurity in place. Now, addressing healthcare workers, Dr. Esperanza Luindao encouraged them to take ownership of the digital transformation process, stressing that the reforms are designed to reduce administrative burdens and allow professionals to focus on patient care. And I do remember speaking about doctors taking about 30, 40 minutes in admitting a patient at Katutura State Hospital, because there's so much paperwork that goes through that. Instead of now focusing their time on patient care, they have to balance between that and doing a lot of paperwork. And this, when it comes into full realization, would really cut down on those and, yeah, alleviate pressure from the doctors and the nurses and the medical fraternity as a whole. She also encouraged the technical support provided by the World Health Organization and called on developmental partners, pardon me, to align their investment and expertise with the national implementation plan. And she said that the adoption of the national digital health policy signals Namibia's commitment to building a unified, rights-based and forward-looking health system, adding that the work on the necessary registration has already begun, marking the country's transition from policy to implementation. And I quote, this policy is a promise that no Namibian will be left behind due to lack of information or access, she said. That is at the official declaration of the National Digital Health Policy for 2026 to 2036 launch. Now, speaking on the importance of this and the significance of this, is that it strengthens the country's health system by improving efficiency and also equity and quality of care through the use of technology, and that the policy aims to replace fragmented paper-based systems, as you heard from Walter Skamaya right there, with interoperable digital platforms that allow patient records to be securely, accessed through health facilities, and also reducing delays and duplication of tests and medicine stock out. Now, the World Health Organization promotes digital health as a vital tool for achieving universal health coverage and strengthening health systems and improving global outcomes. Let's take a listen to the World Health Organization director, that is Dr. Tedros Adhanom. Let's take a listen to him as he speaks on a digital health message.
Excellencies, dear colleagues and friends, digital health is not about applications, platforms, or devices. It's about transforming how health systems serve people more equitably, more effectively, and with greater attention to individual needs. When digital systems are designed well and implemented responsibly, they work for people. Health workers are paid on time. People carry their health records with them and access care across borders. And governments can track health spending and make sure it reaches the right place at the right time and has the expected result. These are not future aspirations. Their outcomes we're already seeing in many countries. But they require more than innovation. They require alignment between partners, policies, and priorities. They require strong foundations in governance, infrastructure, financing, and trust.
Fall in love with the best prices at WB. Get 500 gram Bokomo cornflakes for $31.99. 2 kg nice rice for only $34.99. 1.5 kg real good mixed chicken portions for $79.99. And 10 kg Bokomo fat cook flour for just $137.99. See more February specials at furmanbrock.com. We care.
And they require countries to lead their digital health transformation based on national strategies and local systems. That's why the extension and renewal of the global strategy on digital health is so important. It contains actions countries have prioritized for WHO, for partners, and for their own digital transformation. Since 2020, we have made significant progress together. 129 countries have now developed national digital health strategies, and almost 70 countries have assessed their digital maturity through the Global Digital Health Monitor. More than 1,600 government officials have been trained in digital health and artificial intelligence. Through the Global Digital Health Certification Network, more than 1.8 billion people in 82 countries now have secure, portable access to their health records. WHO is helping countries develop national digital health architecture and governance frameworks. The WHO Science Council has also focused its work on the responsible use of digital technologies in global health. We're supporting the responsible use of artificial intelligence with guidance on ethics, safety, and regulation. And through smart guidelines and capacity building on open standards, we're enabling countries to build locally owned, interoperable solutions. WHO's role is to advance science, to set clear and trusted standards, and to help countries build systems that are resilient, inclusive, and sustainable. Because the only digital transformation worth pursuing is one that leaves no one behind. Together, we must ensure that the use of digital tools to narrow inequities rather than widen them, that data is collected and used ethically and transparently, and that every tool moves us closer to a world where health is not a luxury for some, but a right for all. I thank you.
And with that being said, let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with more news.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events. And Basically, any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Likurane ngeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshiwana. Ono ngeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu matatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now today, the government of the Republic of Namibia commemorates Namibia Constitution Day, marking the adoption of the Namibian Constitution in 1990 as the supreme law of the land and the foundation of the country's democratic order. Now, the Constitution was reflected by a 72-member Constituent Assembly under the leadership of the late founding Prime Minister and President, Dr. Hage G. Geingob, bringing together former adversaries from the liberation struggle into a historic act of national unity. Now, the Namibian Constitution is widely regarded as a cornerstone of peace, of stability, and good governance, enshrining fundamental human rights and freedoms while upholding accountability, the separation of powers, which you talked about the other day, and the rule of law. Now, it empowers citizens to actively participate in the governance of the country and serves as a guiding framework for democratic institutions, policy formulation, and service delivery. Now, as Namibia commemorates Constitution Day, the government calls on all citizens to reflect on shared constitutional values and to reaffirm their collective responsibility to uphold, protect, and advance the principles enshrined in the Constitution. That is the Constitution of Namibia. Now, the commemoration underscores the Constitution's enduring importance in promoting social cohesion, inclusive development, and the continuous improvement of quality of life for all Namibians as the country walks towards a peaceful, inclusive, and prosperous future for present and future generations. Now, joining me telephonically is Anna Maria Shikomber, a citizen of Namibia, to speak on what Constitution D actually means for her. A very good afternoon to you, Anna Maria, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, so now today we're commemorating Namibia Constitution Day, you being a citizen of Namibia. Just does what does the Namibia Constitution Day, or just the Constitution of Namibia as a whole? I mean, we know growing up we've heard every child has a right to education, right to this and right to that. What does it mean for you, and what does it remind you of? Anna Maria, I can't hear you at all.
Okay. My apologies. It is a very important day. It is the constitution of our country is very important because it gives us rights. It gives us rights as citizens of this country. As growing up, We have been taught as children of this country that every child has a right to education. So we are many children out there in this country. 90% of the children in this country are going to school. Why? Because of our constitution. We are protected. It is a very good initiative. And it is also protecting workers. It protects workers from exploitation, that the employers cannot exploit their workers. You see, it is a regulating body that is regulating things in this country, which is very important, which is very good. You find some other countries where things are just being done the way anyhow. Leadership are just doing the things anyhow. But our country, it's a very good thing that we are upholding our constitution and we are living by it.
Correct, Anna. Now, what do you say perhaps that we should do to ensure that the constitution remains, or how should maybe citizens ensure that they don't infringe on other people's rights?
The constitution needs to be upholded. It needs to be respected. It needs to be respected. So if somebody is going against your rights, you have the right to call the police. That is what the police is here for. You have the right to call the police. You have the right to make a lawsuit. The constitution will protect you. Okay? According in the court there, you are going to be protected. So somebody is infringing upon your rights, your constitutional rights. You have the right to talk. You must talk.
Anna?
Yes,
are you still there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, of course, indeed, we do hear of atrocities that people commit against other people, that is infringing on other people's rights, and this already is going against the constitution of Namibia. Everybody has the right to live. Everybody has the right to freedom of speech. Yes, everybody has, you know, all those incorporated in within the constitution of Republic of Namibia. How perhaps, or what message would you have towards such people, you know, in terms of us wanting to ensure that we stay grounded and we ensure that the constitution of Namibia remains intact? Of course, it will remain intact, but then we uphold it as citizens of Namibia.
It is very important for us to know our constitutional rights. Very important. So some of the people are very ignorant of their constitutional rights. They can just get run over anyhow. But it's very important for us as citizens to personally take our time to read our constitution, to know our rights. Very important. And once we know our rights, once our rights are being violated, we have the right to involve the law of this nation. You have the right as a citizen of this nation, if somebody is violating your rights, you have the law, the authority to involve the law. Call the police, file a lawsuit, or do something. Yes. Yes.
That's an important part that you mentioned right there. It's important for all of us to know our rights or to know our constitution, and it's up to us to actually study or browse through, even if it's not extensive studies of the constitution of the Republic of Namibia. And from my understanding, constitution books are very much free, but it's important that we know our rights so that when the next person infringes on our rights, we are able to say, no, but Article 21, Clause B, or whatsoever, says this and that, you know, so that then at the end of the day, we stand up not only for ourselves, but for the next person who might not know their rights. Yeah. Your last words, Anna?
My last word is just that. As I said before, we need to know our constitutional rights. There was a particular story that was going viral just a month ago, just a few months ago, of a couple in the there at magistrate's court. They got married, and the couple were told to kiss, and they refused because of their religious rights. And what happened was, the judge stormed out of the courtroom and said he's not going to wed these people because they are not listening to him, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was viral news all over. But these people came back, and they brought, came back with their constitutional rights. That the constitution says that all citizens of this country have the right to practice their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it was later on, after convincing that the judge now declared them husband and wife and gave them their certificate. Yes. So it is very important for you to know your constitutional rights, because if you don't know your rights, you are going to be violated, and you don't even know that your rights were violated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my final remark is just that. Know your constitutional rights.
Interesting. Now you bring up a very interesting, you trigger something also in my mind. Back then in Chinatown, there was an incident, that time I was not in the media fraternity. But then I did read about, a Chinese national who then would, use the bathroom in a plastic and give it to the workers to go take it to the dustbin. And this was a practice that was going on for quite some time until somebody actually spoke out, or it was an outsider that identified it. But, from the very get-go, from the very beginning, if the workers knew their rights, that this is inhumane, that Namibian citizens are not supposed to be put I don't even know the right words to actually say that it's wrong, it's morally wrong, it's ethically, it's not ethical. Perhaps maybe then they would have stood up from the very get-go without fear, and it would have been a thing of all people actually coming together and rising up against that such behavior. Now, but there are really times and areas where, maybe not so common, but somewhere, there are people who are saying, no, but I'm not enjoying, my constitutional rights in the Republic of Namibia because so is doing this and that. Then there comes also a time of wave of ignorance where people don't know that the next person is infringing on their rights, even if they are. Why? Because they're not educated on the aspect or on the matter.
And that is why it is very important for us to have political analysts, for us to have advocates in this country. Because if everyone is quiet, how will the people know? So we have people of the likes of Job and Panda. They are always out there saying something. They have a voice, giving other people a voice. Or just random people out there, advocates. They're advocating for people's rights, this, that. It is very important that we as citizens of this country, who are also minded, we also love our fellow citizens. Mm-hmm. You who know the law better than the other one, stand up and go and talk for the other one.
Sure.
Because maybe the other one does not have a voice. Just like that example you gave me from Chinatown. That person, it was another person who came to speak for him. You see?
Sina.
But the person themselves were quiet.
Interesting. Anna, thank you so much for this conversation that we had regarding Namibia Constitution Day. Let's go out there and ensure that we uphold our own rights and the rights of other people.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Now, a strong constitution is the backbone of any country because it defines how power is exercised, limited, and held accountable. It is the highest law of the land, meaning no individual, no institution, or government authority stands above it. Hence the saying, no one is above the law. Now, a strong constitution protects its citizens from abuse of power by guaranteeing fundamental rights and freedoms, ensuring equality before the law, and safeguarding human dignity. Just today, I actually read something on on Facebook by somebody who is Kenyan and has lived here in Namibia, schooled here in Namibia, and they said that Namibia judges its people by their criteria and not by their ethnicity or so. I tend to believe that, you know, I tend to really believe that we are really in a society where if you stand up to speak, you are allowed the platform to speak. You are allowed to air your voices and your opinions and you give your contributions, regardless of your background, regardless of your color, regardless. It's something that we need to really appreciate. And another thing that I would want to point out, a particular lady when she was traveling from Uganda to Namibia, and she was surprised when, at the checkpoint, you know, the plane that is going to Namibia, whether it was, we know which country was that, wherever she was coming from, you know, not from Uganda, but then she had to pass through another country. She said she noticed that it was a lot of white people that were going to Namibia. She started questioning herself and wondering, am I going to the right country? Because I know I'm going to visit, I'm a black person. I'm going to visit other, people of color, you know, in Namibia. And it's just a whole lot of white people that gives you, but opposed to other countries, it was more like a mixture and that kind of stuff. But then it shows something. To be honestly speaking, there is democratic, the right, for everybody to really to begin their family here and to, you know, live in a peaceful manner. Of course, I'm not saying there's no crime at all in Namibia, but I'm actually trying to point out that right here in the land of the brave, you can actually go to town as a tourist or a foreigner and ask for directions and you will be well guided. You know, people won't, mistreat you because of your accent. Unlike in other countries, from what I hear, the moment they notice that you have a different accent, it already triggers to say you're not from around the, and you become a prey, you become a target. So constitution establishes democratic institution and guides governance and provides stability by setting clear rules that apply regardless of who is in power. Now, in terms of political change or national crisis, a constitution serves as an anchor, preventing arbitrary rule and preserving peace, preserving justice, and preserving national unity. However, a constitution is only as strong as the commitment of its citizens to it. Citizens have a civic obligation to understand the constitution, to respect its principles, and defend it against violation. Now, this includes obeying the law, number one, participating in democratic processes such as elections and public consultations, holding leaders accountable through lawful means, and standing up for the rights of others, and not only their own. And I had Anna actually add to it that it was another person that actually came, you know, to stand up for the next person. Why? This one had understanding of their rights and the rights of the next person. Now, citizens must also reject corruption, whether it first begins with themselves rejecting corruption before actually pointing it out in the lives of other people. Intolerance and abuse of authority, as thus weaken constitutional governance. Also, when citizens actively uphold constitutional values, they transform the constitution from a written document into a living social contract that protects democracy, that strengthens institutions, and that secures a just and prosperous future for generations to come. So on this particular day, Namibia ought to reflect on what actually Constitution Day means and whether we ourselves are really obeying the Constitution. We are upholding it as we should. But nonetheless, this is On The Radar News Analysis. 0832888401 is the number in studio. I repeat that slowly. 0832888401. For now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. You're welcome to come through and air opinions or contributions. Ask questions right here on the Reader News Analysis.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And now, of course, we take you to economic indicators before we get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. We're comparing the Namibian dollar to other currencies. Now, one US dollar today is equal to 16 Namibian dollars, 0.08 cents, and 1 euro is equal to 19 Namibian dollars, 0.02 cents. 1 Swiss franc is equal to 20 Namibian dollars, 0.84 cents, while 1 pound sterling is equal to 21 Namibian dollars, 0.94 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars and 38 cents, and 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. And now let's cross over to news beyond the borders of Namibia, where we start off regionally, move over to continental news. Thereafter, I'll bring you international news right here on the Reader News Analysis. Now we're starting off in South Africa on mining in Durban 2026. With a focus on mining technology, sustainability and investment. And today begins a four-day conference that is in South Africa. Let's take a listen.
Durban begins today for a four-day conference at the International Convention Center in Cape Town. The gathering has become an important event for mining professionals, investors and industry leaders who are looking to capitalize on the vast opportunities that exist in African mining. Watching that story is SABC News reporter Katlego Lihodi, live to us now from Cape Town in the Western Cape, and it certainly is a major item on the mining calendar. Katlego, help us get a better sense of what's likely to be ventilated there today.
A very good morning to you, Ayanda, and to our viewers at home, welcoming you once again into the Cape Town International Convention Center. This is where any moment from now, we're expecting for the Investing in African Mining in Durban 2026 to get well underway. This is, as you stated, Ayanda, rightly so, a high-level event. We've seen various of those important people from the continent, not just in Africa or South Africa alone, but from the continent and the globe just coming into Cape Town for this mining in Durban. It happens every year, and this year it carries the theme Stronger Together, a partnerships investment. And this is where they're looking at ensuring as well that they come through with these partnerships that will move the mining sector forward. Very important for South Africa, Ayanda, because you know very well that this is somewhat of a bedrock of the country's economy in terms of how we see the mineral sector flowing and feeding into the economy. Here, we're talking about 6 to 7.5% economic contribution into the country's GDP. But again, they're looking at ensuring that they learn, right, from their partners and their counterparts in terms of how they're doing it, where they come from. This is why it was very important, even last night, Ayanda, to see Minister Gwede Mantashe, who will be giving an opening address here, gather the ministers from the continent to sit down and look at the issue of critical minerals. You asked as well to say, what is it that we can expect to be on the spotlight in terms of today going into the week? The issue of beneficiation, Ayanda, that is what will come under the spotlight. The critical minerals and how we see them working for the continent and the country expected to come under the spotlight, but exploration as well. How are we driving exploration from source and ensuring as well that all of these conversations and what is happening in these countries is not lost? So we're expecting as well, this is a record number of delegates to date, about 11,000, Ayanda, of those delegates that are spread out through this auditorium this morning. They're expecting to get that opening address from Minister Gwede Mantashe, who will just lay the land in terms of what we can expect in the coming 4 days. But again, important will be the Zambian President, Hakainde Hichilema, who will be coming through here, Ayanda, to give a keynote address. And earlier on as well, a very important one kicking us off would be the Minerals Council. They were giving us a state of the mining industry in South Africa, reflecting on how 2025 has been. And you can really see that the mineral sector is turning a corner. But there are some of those impediments, Ayanda, the challenges, the issue of the cost of electricity. We've seen the smelters closing down. This would be jobs, right? So they are saying that the cost of electricity is affecting production, which is why they would want as well to see this ventilated here. But we are also tweaking legislation as South Africa in terms of what we can expect from the mineral sector. And this is why Minister Gwede Mantashe will be coming through to give them a sense and an update of where we are in terms of policy, in terms of legislation, but at the same time to present progress after the launch of the Junior Exploration Fund. And this is where they were looking at targeting junior miners to come through and some of those small businesses to come through that are focusing on exploration. But you know very well that most of them will talk about the issue of corruption, the issue of crime. These are some of the issues that are affecting the sector. Here at home, we talk about zamazamas. So they'll be looking at ensuring that they tighten legislation that would ensure that they push to close some of these derelict mines. But at the same time, they intensify Operation Valum Godi to ensure that all of these, you know, illegal activities in the mineral sector don't take away from how South Africa is doing as per this sector. So we're expecting for these to be high-level conversations, Ayanda, that will be fused and turbocharged by the investments that will be expected to flow from here into various of these economies on the continent. Ayanda, any moment from now, if you can see behind me, the stage is set and we're expecting for the opening address by Minister Gwede Mantashe. But like I said, later on, we'll be seeing the Zambian President Hakainde Hichilema, who'll be coming through to give a keynote address. Ayanda, it's back to you.
How I appreciate a reporter that gives enough information on a particular event. Now, Western Cape has launched a 19.5 million rand irrigation revival.
The Eastern Cape Department of Agriculture has officially launched a major drive to revive provincial irrigation schemes, investing more than 19.5 million rand to boost food production and fight poverty. Agriculture MEC Nonceba Nkonsiwe unveiled the initiative at the Zanyokwe Irrigation Scheme in Geiskamme Hoek, saying that the program will support vegetable, grain and fodder production while creating jobs and strengthening the province's rural economy. For more on this, let's now speak to the Eastern Cape MEC for Agriculture, Nonceba Nkonsiwe. Ma'am, a very good afternoon to you and thank you so much for your time. Perhaps the MEC, unpack this initiative for us and importantly, who stands to benefit for this 19.5 million rand investment, and how of course, are you ensuring that it doesn't end up favoring a small group of already established producers? I think that's also one of the concerns there.
Thanks to you and greetings to the viewers. Yes, we have launched it. The irrigation scheme program in Zanyoko and Pobopobo. But we have launched it because we are going to revive all irrigation schemes in different district municipalities in the province, in Amatole, which is Zanyoko, in O.R. Tambo, and the other one in Krisani. So with that 9.5 million, we are reviving these irrigation schemes. We ensure that where we revive these irrigation schemes, there are water resources where we can get some waters. There are dams, rivers, but they will be where water is not scarce. So we hope, and we have seen with the ones that are operating, that they are doing very well. So majority of the groups that are operating in those irrigation schemes, they do very well. So we are hoping the number will increase as the years go by.
MEC, I'm not sure if you've answered that question in terms of, you know, who exactly qualifies then to benefit from the scheme?
Grouping themselves into a co-op or entrepreneurship. So those that have applied and you have seen that they are doing some work, they do qualify. Anyone who can come up and identify an area where there is a resource of water, then they do qualify. Then the only thing that can make us not to fund everyone else, it's going to be the issue of budget allocation. Otherwise, other than that, we encourage people to group themselves together and then we bring them and support them as the department.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned the issue of water, and I think it's an important one since we are focusing on just the water crisis in the country. The province itself is no stranger to drought, as well as aging infrastructure and water losses. So how confident are you, you know, that irrigation schemes of this nature are water secure and climate resilient, I would imagine, just in the medium to long term?
The ones that you are reviving, the identified ones, the Zanyoko, Amata, and the ones in O.R. Tambo, they are better placed in areas where we can see the resource of water is there in terms of dams and rivers. So at least with those, we are confident that there is no way that they can go dry, because even our engineers have tested that. So that is why we have taken a decision that those areas that have better areas, water resources, at least must be utilized.
Yeah. And of course, we've noted the job creation part of it. But MEC, you know, the Eastern Cape consistently records some of the highest levels of food insecurity and child malnutrition, especially in the country, particularly in rural districts. How does this irrigation revival program directly respond to those nutritional realities on the ground? Perhaps also just speak to us to that, please, in terms of the benefits.
One of the reasons why we have decided to revive in this seventh administration is because we want to fight poverty and create more employment. And as they work in those fields, because this year we are going to revive 10 irrigation schemes, which is 10,000 hectares. You can't do that without at least increasing the number of people to work there. So that's job creation. And if it's a season, those, when the time comes for them to harvest, then the numbers increase. So in a way, as much as we are reviving this, we are creating jobs and fighting poverty at the same time. We also want them to graduate from being primary producers to join the value chain and become commercial farmers.
All right, MEC will be monitoring that particular project of...
Let's now cross over to Zambia as Zambia pushes for value addition.
China Spring Festival Temple Fair characterized the 2026 Zambia-China Spring Festival Temple Fair in Lusaka. The festival is the Chinese New Year of the Horse, which symbolizes freedom, energy, and confidence. Vice President Mutalina Lumango graced the event. Mrs. Nalumango said Zambia has embraced industrialization with special emphasis on value addition, picking lessons from China and other developed countries.
as Zambia and indeed the rest of the world admires the industrialization of China and the positive impact it has had on the well-being of the Chinese people, particularly in the lifting of millions of people out of poverty. It is gratifying to note that Zambia has also embraced industrialization with special emphasis on value addition and beneficiation to its natural resources dotted across the country as an engine for socio-economic transformation of the people's lives.
Mrs. Nalumango said she is confident that the event will also catalyze the dynamism of business linkages between Zambia and China. Meanwhile, Tourism Minister Rodney Sekumba said government is working towards introducing direct flights between Zambia and China.
In 2025, Zambia did welcome our Chinese colleagues with open arms by waiving off visa restrictions. And we're just hoping, and we're working behind the scenes and tirelessly so, that the visa waiver will be done to reciprocate what we have extended to our colleagues in China.
And Chinese Church of Affairs Wang Sheng said the Spring Festival is a cultural heritage that carries the best wishes of families.
Ripe Spring Festival couplets and authentic Chinese cuisine not only fill us with joy of the new year, but also allow people in this country to get a glimpse of the Chinese culture. May Zambia make greater strides in national development and enjoy greater prosperity in the years ahead.
Speaking at the same event, Zambia Chinese Association Executive President said the event is an opportunity for greater partnerships.
Today, we are not only celebrating our Chinese festival, but also sharing during cross-culture. We are very glad to celebrate together with our Zambia friends.
The Vice President congratulated the Chinese people on the successful commemoration of the Spring Festival. Mary Kachepa, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
Mineral production in Zambia is set to beat 2025 levels.
Zambia's mineral production for 2025 saw a sharp rise, with copper estimated to be around 890,346 tons. This represents an 8% increase from the 2024 production figures. Stakeholders in the extractive industry have attributed this to a shift in strategies and good environment for investment.
With all this, you know, the policies that are being implemented, as well as the setting up of this, you know, the mining and minerals tribunal, practically sorted out all these issues in the mining sector. I think we expect more production, because if I go to the tribunal in the past, you know, we had issues. Sometimes you have one license being owned maybe by three people, four people. Everyone with papers, you don't know who is the owner.
Dr. Nirenda is encouraging the government and the mining companies to remain focused toward attaining the 3 million tons of copper production by 2031.
For gold, you know, the major supply of gold is basically Kansanshi mine. So you see, with the expansion of Kansanshi mine, obviously it was expected that even gold production is actually going to increase. Yeah, for copper, we are, at least there was some improvement. We didn't meet the 1 million metric tons, you know what we expected. But what was recorded is actually the highest in history. If you go back in history, it's about 890,000 tons. That was the highest we've actually achieved.
Government has also been praised for bringing order in the mining sector.
The mining industry is in motion. It has stabilized. It has come back from the dead levels to somewhere where now you can point at. We have noted with gratitude that copper production has continued increasing. In 2024, we recorded an upward movement in terms of copper figures. Even in 2025, even when we expected more, but we saw a positive sign. meaning that the investment that these mining companies are putting in, both in the old mines and the new ones, is actually paying.
Chembe Mbale, ZMBC News in Kitwe.
Tunisia boosts recycling to cut waste and create jobs.
Recycling is a Tunis-based company handling 10 to 15 tons of waste every day. Since its creation in 2009, the facility has supported Tunisia's national recycling efforts and environmental objectives. The company's head says it has become a highly sophisticated operation.
Cardboard waste is compressed here using specialized machines and then transported into factories to be recycled into corrugated cardboards. As for plastic waste, such as plastic bags, it is shredded and processed before being transformed into plastic pellets, which compete with pellets derived from petroleum.
Masmoudi's company is a public-private partnership, a model which has become increasingly popular in waste management, as it provides solutions to both sides. He says projects such as his are crucial in addressing the growing challenges of waste disposal in Tunisia.
We did face some challenges in the waste recycling sector, but in coordination with the Minister of Environment, we addressed them. The current challenge is that Tunisia needs to...
Esira shisho, pagyotari kukwathere opoguro kara uwasira ya kweni ochisho. Watuchi ithana basic mental health first aid course. Haiganjwa oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo nakene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko igena cha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano gopama viraviro kuchane omokati koku mekoe ninge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo kene una okuya kwathera nukuya pa eabidido yiri mwanjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere ounji na kene unokara uishangitha tarira po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na ehangono maradura thano ododina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Focus on selective waste sorting, especially plastic waste, and recyclable materials, starting from households and public administrations.
It's helping support the circular economy by lowering landfill reliance, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and preserving natural resources. But it's not just an environmental solution. Experts note that expanding recycling streams from electronic waste to street-collected plastics are becoming key drivers of job creation. And as they learn, it's also offering pathways for informal workers to formalize their activity.
These sectors could create really a lot of opportunities to develop the circular economy, to create a good economic dynamic, and could create a lot of job opportunities in the North African countries.
For Tunisia, scaling up recycling now hinges on expanding selective waste sorting at the source. Authorities say stronger collection systems and citizen engagement will be key to sustaining momentum and unlocking the full economic and environmental potential of a circular economy.
With recycling capacity expanding, Tunisia's next challenge is waste sorting at the source, requiring stronger coordination, public awareness, and sustained investment. Adnan Shawishi, CGTN, Tunis.
Illegal fishing has threatened the livelihoods and the marine ecosystem in Zanzibar.
Vessels have arrived at this Kilwa seaside market in southern Tanzania, and competition among vendors quickly follows. The agency reflects a deeper problem. Vendors say the daily catch has fallen sharply.
The fish is very little these days. That's why we fight. Everyone wants something to sell, but there is not enough.
Local fishermen say boats that once returned with full nets are increasingly coming back half empty, a trend widely linked to illegal fishing in African coastal waters. To understand the impact of illegal fishing, I have come here at the Nairobi City Market to talk to those affected, the men and women in the business chain. Consolata Ocheng has been selling fish at this market for years now. She says the impact is huge.
Kwa kweli, inatudhuru.
Nowadays, we get fewer and smaller fishes. Sometimes our customers come and go back empty-handed.
Experts agree the situation is dire.
And the figures are staggering. The numbers are just staggering. In total, the continent loses about $11 billion to illegal fishing. $11 billion. I mean, in my region, for instance, in the West African sub-region, for instance, it's between $2 to $3 billion to illegal fishing.
Despite repeated regional commitments, including a recent regional summit in Zanzibar, enforcement remains a major challenge.
If you don't have systems that will check me when I come into your EEZ, there's nothing to deter me. So I would always come, do whatever that I want to do illegally, and then move out of there.
He says stronger cross-border cooperation, shared monitoring systems, and tougher penalties are essential if the war on illegal fishing is to be won.
Legal harmonization is key. Political will is key. Sustained financing and external accountability is key. You know, we need to be accountable to one another because, like I said, most of these illegalities that happen at sea are transnational.
But until then, communities on African coasts and cities say the cost of illegal fishing is growing while catches are shrinking. Enoxi Kolia, CGTN.
Meanwhile, the African coffee is finding a growing market in China.
The week-long conference, which closed on Friday, united stakeholders from the coffee value chain, including farmers, exporters, and international buyers, to discuss critical issues such as quality, sustainability, and market access. This is as China's consumption of African coffee is rapidly increasing due to urban lifestyles and a burgeoning cafe culture. As the continent's largest coffee producer, Ethiopia's exports to China soared from over 16,000 tons in the last 5 months compared to 12,000 tons over the same period the previous year.
China has recently become one of the largest importers of Ethiopian coffee and the second largest buyer from Africa. It is now competing strongly with European markets and is expected to become one of the leading destinations for Ethiopian coffee. Chinese companies have quickly moved into the top ranks of importers in Ethiopia, and several Chinese investors have already obtained licenses and started operations, which is strengthening cooperation, increasing coffee trade between the two countries.
Traders say Chinese consumers are showing a preference for specialty beans, particularly Ethiopian and East African varieties, which are gaining traction in cafes and retail outlets. This exhibition has facilitated partnerships between Chinese buyers and African exporters in various areas, including logistics, roasting, and branding.
Last year, we have like more than 400 containers from Ethiopia coffee to the China to support the market in China. Because everyone knows that the China coffee industry is a bomb there. And more clients, they will pick Ethiopia coffee in their SOE, in their recipe, in their like the signature drink. So more and more people fall in love with the Ethiopia coffee.
This growth is not isolated to Ethiopia. Other African nations, such as Uganda, are also enhancing their coffee exports to China, boosted by government-led promotion and direct market engagement.
The Chinese market is extremely important for Uganda. And actually, we are very excited to have our friends from China. They are now taking our coffee. I can tell you that coffee exports to China have increased by 270% in the past 2 years. So Uganda has grown as a very big exporter of coffee to China. And we want this market to grow even further. And government support is there for them. So this is one of our key destinations. In fact, we have our office in China. It's promoting coffee.
Analysts say that the evolving Africa-China coffee trade signifies a broader economic shift towards stronger South-to-South cooperation, allowing African producers to view coffee as a strategic bridge in long-term trade partnerships. Crystal Onkel, CGTN.
The U.S. wants Russia and Ukraine to end the war by June, says Volodymyr Zelensky.
Ukraine's President Zelensky says Ukraine and Russia have been invited to talks next week and that the U.S. is pushing to end the war by June. The development comes as Ukraine says Russia has carried out a huge attack on its critical energy facilities, triggering emergency power outages in most regions. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Sarah Rainsford, gave us this update on those attacks.
The focus this time appears to have been in the centre and the west of the country. We have reports this morning of major power outages in western Ukraine in particular and across the country. So this is Lviv region, this is Ivano-Frankivsk, this is Rivne in the centre of Ukraine. Again, Russia has been deliberately in a focused way, targeting the energy infrastructure, which is something of a pattern this winter. Of course, it has been a particularly cold winter this year, and that has led to these massive outages of power that we've seen, and many people left without central heating, without hot water, and sometimes without electricity in their homes. So that is a campaign which has continued overnight. We were at a power station here in Kyiv just yesterday to witness some of the damage that had been done there in repeated attacks earlier in the month. So a few days ago here in Kyiv, that particular power station was hit with five ballistic missiles, and the damage is enormous. In fact, that power plant, which at the time was only generating heating, it was not even generating electricity because of previous damage, that power plant won't be repaired this winter. The damage is obvious. It is immense. The place has been smashed to smithereens. So Russia's attacks continue. And again, yes, it was a major attack overnight, particularly focused on the West.
Give us a sense of what the locals are making of that, because obviously the Russians are targeting the power because then they're in the freezing conditions. How are they getting through the days without that power?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's clear that these attacks are supposed to be debilitating. They're supposed to make Ukrainians angry, presumably to turn them against their own authorities and to demand a stop to this war, to demand that Ukraine makes concessions. You might think logically that would be what happened, but it's not what we found here. It's certainly not the mood on the ground. We've been to speak to many people in recent days and the last couple of weeks who have no heating, who have no hot water, who are living in really tough conditions at home, and they are getting through. And in fact, I think if anything, the resilience has increased. They are not in any mood for compromise or for surrender, certainly. They are managing how they can. People who have gas in their homes will heat bricks on the gas stoves to give out extra warmth. One lady we met in one city, she was boiling pans of water, putting a lid on it and popping her feet on top of the saucepan to keep her feet warm. People wearing multiple layers of clothing, going to bed in their coats and in their hats. But still, as I say, it does seem that the mood is very much one of continuing to defend Ukraine and certainly not giving in to the compromises that Russia is demanding, particularly in terms of handing over territory to Moscow.
Now, President Zelensky has been talking about the talks. What has he been saying? Is there any optimism?
Well, I think on the positive side, there are a couple of things. There was another prisoner exchange this week. So more than 150 Ukrainians returned home, Russian prisoners of war back to Russia. So that was a proof that there is some engagement. In terms of the talks, too, President Zelensky has said that Russia is engaged in less rhetoric these days and much more focused on the concrete matters of any kind of deal. So particularly, for example, how any ceasefire would be monitored, who would be involved, you know, where lines might be drawn. So instead of giving endless false historical lectures, he said, they are focusing on the practicalities. And that's partly because the makeup of the Russian team negotiating has changed. So a more serious approach, he argues. But again, he is saying that Russia is insisting on taking territory for free, that Ukraine will not hand over. One interesting point I think he did make is that there is now some serious discussion about whether there might be at some point a trilateral meeting between Presidents Zelensky, Donald Trump Trump and Vladimir Putin of Russia to discuss what he said were the most complicated parts of any peace deal. So he said they might have to be left to the presidents to discuss, and that that was something that Ukraine was open to. But that is, I think, a long way off at the moment. At the moment, there is massive disagreement over territory and no sign of any compromise.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Kyiv.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is attempting to choke Cuba economically, according to the Cuban deputy foreign minister.
Cuba poses no threat to the United States. They are attempting to choke Cuba economically, as they have been trying to do for the past over six decades, I would say. At this moment, they are threatening countries with tariffs to harm them if they, in use of their national prerogatives, they export fuel to Cuba. That would pose a great harm to Cuba. It is the aim to cause as much harm as possible to the people of Cuba.
Cuba has only 15 to 20 days of oil left at current levels of demand. That's according to the Financial Times. With the U.S. blocking deliveries from Venezuela, a key supplier, and pressuring Mexico to cancel shipments while also threatening new tariffs on any country that sells oil to Havana. The Trump administration is choking off the Cuban economy one gas tank at a time. Now, oil doesn't just drive Cuba's transportation infrastructure. It also powers an electricity system on the brink of total collapse. But could talks with Washington give Cuba an off-ramp? Donald Trump thinks so.
I think they probably would come to us and want to make a deal. So Cuba would be free again. They'll come to us, they'll make a deal. But Cuba really, they've got a problem.
Carlos Fernandez de Cossio is Cuba's deputy foreign minister and its top diplomat for U.S. affairs. And he says Havana is even now exchanging messages with Washington and is ready for meaningful dialogue. Carlos Fernandez de Cossio, welcome to the program. So it appears that you are confirming what we heard from President Trump when he said that his administration is talking to the highest people in your government. He also says that he expects a deal. To be clear, is your government currently working or currently looking at a proposal or demand, actually, from the United States?
The U.S. government knows that Cuba is ready and has been ready for a long time to have a meaningful dialogue with the U.S. government to deal with our bilateral issues. At the moment, we've had some exchanges of messages, but we cannot say we have set a bilateral dialogue at this moment.
It seems like a complete 180 from what your president was saying just last week, noting that measures taken by Washington are, quote, criminal and genocidal in nature. Now you're ready to talk. What has changed is the pressure from the United States.
And with that being said, we have officially come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onko Nana Dingi program, brought to you by Luis Ashimi from Indo-Afa. Happy Juju. It is goodbye. I'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place.